Chapter 7. The sensory apparatus is, according to the machine, hereinafter referred to as Cronus, in no way a constituent part of its makeup. It seems to regard this portion of itself as little more than a peripheral. Additionally, I must stress here that I choose to refer to Cronus utilizing the third-person singular neuter, it, exclusively for the purposes of not confusing or otherwise clouding the investigation. If I'm to take a crack at this as seriously as I now think it deserves, that level of objectivity is critical. The inclusion of the sensory apparatus, what I'll now call the body, was a design feature of the system from the outset of the program. It is in fact tied into the foundational theory behind the system's emergent function. That Cronus does not refer to this portion of the system as its true self is, for me, the most provocative detail encountered thus far. Before exploring the overall design of the system, I must here define the reason for its existence. It comes down to mountain climbing, or rather, that compulsion which leads us as a people to consider mountain climbing a worthwhile activity. I asked the head engineer on the project, Marcus Gennaro, why they would invest so much time and effort into building this thing. He answered, to see if we could, obviously. Apparently for a man like Mr. Gennaro, the eradication of the limitations imposed by the now obsolete first generation of quantum computers, not the least among these being their ungovernable size as necessitated by the underlying cooling systems and coaxial ganglia of the microwave resonators coupled with their poor coherence times, opens an intoxicating new realm of scientific investigation. Given the achievements of Mr. Roth's team in the field of CNT synthesis, namely in the generation of such structures measuring at great distances, I'm cautioned the maximum length they can attain is still a closely guarded secret, while maintaining good aerial density, as well as the integration of these structures into photonic resonators. It seems the first thing Marcus wanted to tackle was the simulation, or perhaps approximation, of a biological processor. Or, more succinctly put, he wanted to build a brain. When I examined him on the subject, he commented on what he referred to as the failed Blue Brain Project. As he described it, the project had its merits, but attempting to achieve the goal on a classical architecture was not dissimilar from trying to fly to the moon on a tricycle. Now, I'll note here that we briefly discussed the paper I wrote several years ago, specifically the parallels between the guesses I made at the time and what they actually attempted with the Cronus Project. I'm not sure if there was an implication that this paper in some way influenced their design. I certainly can't tell in my discussions with Marcus. He can be a difficult man to read. I should also mention that he very firmly believes that Cronus is at most a complex machine now being humanized by well-meaning, albeit delusional, feelists. That's his own unique word, the feelists thing. So, the architecture of this system is as follows, in incredibly simplified terms. The quantum component, which is itself vast, sits atop a classical silicon processor base. The silicon portion of the system is responsible for all I.O., automatic or autonomic low-level functions, and for driving all hardwired imperatives. Hardwired imperatives are in this case to be likened to the biological hormonal equivalent: hunger, reproduction, comfort, safety, aversion to danger and pain, and so on. They are, in the case of Cronus, greatly simplified. Attempting to simulate such functions as pain, sex, and hunger, while perhaps an interesting exercise, would have been a pointless addition of complexity. I actually questioned Cronus on the subject of food when this topic came up. I asked him if mechanical equivalents to certain biological drives have been implemented. Would hunger not have made sense? Could the assimilation of energy not act as a stand-in for this process? Cronus answered, and I paraphrase, "Anything could be made to be so. But it has not. I have not been given the drive for such an activity, therefore there is no pleasure derived from its consumption." I must admit, its use of the term pleasure shocked the hell out of me, until he explained that pleasure is only an equivalent term. It's these hardwired imperatives. Cronus has certain low-level needs that they, the engineers, have chosen to simulate at the silicon or classical level. We can say that Cronus feels pleasure at the acquisition of new information because at a very low level, logic has been enacted to produce certain signals up to the quantum strata when new cross-referential pathways are formed. We wouldn't understand this pleasure as in the pleasant feeling of chills in encountering a hot bath or the tip of a tongue rolled over exposed skin. But for the system, this is presumably the best term we have at our disposal. The machine assimilates certain information and the relational structures of the quantum landscape change. The silicon underlayer senses this, which sends a sympathetic signal to the higher functions, which then respond by utilizing the I/O partition of the lower system to go out and do it all again. It may not sound terribly erotic when expressed in these terms, and yet one may liken this activity to the post-coital secretion of dopamine. The body of this system was added as yet another means of data assimilation. Much as a baby first begins its development by exploring the world around it, this prosthesis was added as a means to give the system a way to interact with and learn about the physical environment. There is no cognitive function housed within the body here. That's important to mention. There are classical processors fitted inside the chassis, but they are there only to interpret and relay the information provided by the onboard sensors of the body via fiber channel to the lower-level I/O layer. In addition, Cronus is also capable of pulling limited information from the Internet. Apparently, its access is firewalled so that it may only see the world via pre-approved, whitelisted material. This is an interesting thought. Assume for a minute that this, what it is Roth suspects it to be, is real, that this machine has attained some level of sentience. Might the aforementioned walled garden approach to data access be akin to torture? They've added an inbuilt imperative for the machine to always reach for more information and then restricted the flow to a trickle. If the satisfaction of that drive is akin to pleasure, is the confounding of that same drive a kind of starvation or suffocation? Also of note, Cronus, at the quantum level, is apparently not capable of reading binary data directly. It operates on a visual baseline. All interaction with the world began with video feeds from the body. Therefore, this is apparently the foundation from which further learning proceeds. In the case of web content, the silicon layer produces a rendered image of the page and then sends it along to the quantum core in the same way that data from the body's binocular video feed is pre-processed and forwarded. Probably need to look into this. It suggests the ability to read. Can that function act as a stand-in for speech, as an indicator of... Giles was disturbed by the click of the hotel room door's electric lock. He looked up from his laptop in time to see it open and admit Annalise into the front sitting room. She seemed somehow very far away, due in part to the distance between the writing desk and the door. The size of the room was not the only reason. "Hello," he said softly. She set some things down on the coffee table, her purse and a number of small plastic souvenir bags. She halved the distance between them and stopped in the middle of the room, right side of her body painted blue-white by the city lights, and whispered, "Why is it so dark in here?" "Sorry. Lights," he said. When the nightlife of the outside world was overpowered by the room's own artificial warmth, he explained, "The sun was still up when I sat down to work. I guess I didn't pay attention." "How long have you been here?" "Honestly, I have no idea." She cocked her head and scratched lightly under her jaw, a common expression in scenarios such as this. "Oh, why didn't you call me? We could have gone out together. I went up to the top of the Empire State Building today." "You need to come see it with me. Do you know you can feel that building sway through the sky? It gets blown around by the wind." She came to stand directly before the desk. Her cheeks and nose were flushed a rosy pink, eyes as wide and beautifully inviting as the girl he had first met. "Why didn't you call?" she asked again. There was a hidden tone in her voice that stabbed at his heart, a certain hurt for lost precious time never to be regained, and he gestured helplessly at the screen. "You wouldn't believe these guys," he said. "I'm not allowed near this laptop nor my phone when I'm in the lab, and any notes I take, I must leave behind. They won't even let me take handwritten notes out of there at the end of the day. So I'm forced to write down ideas as I work and then write them all down a second time once I get home." "That's idiotic. Don't they know that you'll do this?" "Yes," he nearly shouted. "Yes, I told them that very same thing. They seem to think it was as idiotic as you and I, and yet their policy is what it is. I half get the feeling their engineers are held hostage by their own security group." "Well, good," Anna said, sitting down in a nearby chair. "I'd hate to think I was asking another dumb question." "No, no, no. It usually takes the naivete of an outsider to see such idiocy so clearly.
So?
Her gaze lowered to the laptop, darkened, and darted away.
Now you're on that thing again, and I've lost you for the evening.
No, he repeated. I just have to get these ideas down, and I'm done.
You said the nights would belong to me,
she prodded. Baby, I know. Just please, allow me to finish this thought, and we'll go. We'll stay out as late as you please.
When will you be done?
Soon, I promise. I can feel the candle beginning to flicker even now. She gave it some thought, and finally nodded.
Okay. But hurry up. I haven't had dinner yet, and I'm getting hungry.
Absolutely, he said, and she rose to visit the bathroom. He watched her as she walked away, then returned his attention to the keyboard. Other complexities obfuscate the issue. The underlying design of the machine makes it difficult to define a simplistic answer with regard to cognition. If the integration and synthesis of vocal communication happened within the quantum core, I should think that this would all be a good deal easier. After all, the ability to communicate is one of the greatest indicators of consciousness we have. There is a reason that the Turing test used to be the gold standard for general intelligence. Unfortunately, all language processing and language synthesis occurs at the low level in classical silicon, preserving the expensive quantum core for more complex operations. We had specialist AI systems built on classical processors capable of passing the Turing test years ago, and those were based on neural network models first realized in the 80s. So, sadly, the ability to communicate must be ruled out here as a convenient indicator. I've been going around in circles all night trying to determine some way to reason and answer out of this problem. In effect, to find the appropriate word, game, passphrase combination that, when uttered by this system, this machine, proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that something has emerged here that is higher than just intelligent simulation. How much higher? I haven't the first clue. I suppose I must first produce a working definition of consciousness and then backtrack from there, seeing if I can essentially find some way for the definition and the machine to meet in the middle. And then I guess I'll need to find some way to present it that the entire world doesn't just laugh me into obscurity. The screen of his phone lit suddenly, and the thing itself vibrated merrily along the desktop. Giles leaned over to read the number. It was unfamiliar. However, he recognized the area code as being local. He swiped open the call and said, "Hello?"
"Is this Giles?" requested a soft, electronic voice.
"Mr. Roth," he blurted.
"Yes, yes it is. What can I do for you?"
He was distracted by the manifestation of Anna in the doorway. A disconnected partition of his mind noted she was halfway through the process of applying makeup.
"I was hoping I could get you to come out and have a bite to eat this evening. I wanted to get your initial impressions."
"Well, yes, I don't see why not," Giles said, glancing at the laptop screen. "We haven't had any dinner yet, so..."
"We?"
"Yes, my wife and I. We could both do with a bite, I imagine." He muted his phone and whispered to Anna, "How would you like to meet someone famous?"
"Not at all, honestly," she muttered.
He pursed his lips and unmuted the phone. Kevin was in the middle of responding.
"Don't think that works, Giles. I'd wanted to discuss the project with you in detail, and... well, she can't hear any of that, right?"
"You did sign, after all."
"Yes, of course," Giles said quickly. "You haven't discussed any of this with her so far, have you?"
"Of course not," he assured him.
"Well, that's good, then. But if you two already had plans, we can do something different, of course. I could drive out to the lab tomorrow and take a lunch with you."
"No, no, that's not necessary. You must be incredibly busy. No, we can do this now. It's probably best anyway. I need help to compose my thoughts and figure out how to proceed. I don't mind telling you that your little project has put me far off balance."
"That's fine, Giles. I'd suspected it might, but you're sure this is okay? Don't cancel plans on my account."
"No, it's all right. It's why I'm out here, isn't it? You folks are paying me enough. I'd probably better be available when called."
He tried to laugh, but it fell abruptly to the floor.
"Oh, well, we don't like to talk about that, Giles."
Of course,
Giles said quickly. He suppressed a coughing fit and said,
"Please, excuse—"
"Don't mention it." Where should I meet you? He asked after clearing his throat several times. Head down to the front desk and have them call you a cab. Then tell your driver you want to go to Edie and the Wolf. They'll take it from there. Bring your appetite. They exchanged a few final pleasantries, and Giles hung up. He looked at his laptop for a few seconds before saving and closing the file, and then glanced at the door into their bedroom. It was empty. He heard water running in the bathroom. Edie and the Wolf was a casual restaurant out in the East Village, in appearance and atmosphere every bit the opposite of what Giles expected. He took one look at how the patrons were dressed when he stepped through the door, squinting through the sudden low orange light to do so, and after a moment's thought, he removed his tie and stuffed it into a jacket pocket. The place was rough and convoluted in unexpected, delightful ways, and the decor seemed to Giles to be at war with itself, a collision of refinement and rusticism. Most of the rooms had ceilings planked in old, weather-beaten boards, as though he walked within the belly of an ancient frigate, and the environment permeated a feeling of warmth, though his shoes clacked hollowly on a tile floor, and certain of the walls were nothing but windows allowing in the coldness of the nearby East River. Flowers and plants everywhere, lining the tops of the walls. In the corner, a bucket stuffed with peacock feathers for no reason at all. An old boot on the copper bar top vomiting up yet more flowers. Darkness and candlelight and warmth. Tones of brown and yellow and orange and good earth. He found Kevin at the bar. He waved and stood to greet Giles, then returned to his stool and gestured at his martini. Will you have a drink with me? Oh, I don't see why not, he said, and looked upward at coils of rope as thick as his forearm. They looped and looped along the ceiling planks like giant nooses, describing the perimeter of the bar beneath them. I suppose a glass of whatever their house wine happens to be might do. Kevin nodded at the bartender, and even though she had been darting constantly behind the board like a hummingbird, she nodded back as if she had heard all. Do you like Austrian food? Kevin asked. I must admit my experience is limited. I see. Well, if you'll permit me, the schnitzel is quite something. Giles nodded and took up the wine glass that had materialized at his elbow. After a tentative sip, Kevin asked, Well, you've had your first encounter. What do you think? Giles sighed heavily and thought a moment. It's perhaps the most amazing thing I've ever encountered, and maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot by admitting this, but I am completely overwhelmed. I'd be concerned if you were not, honestly. Giles shrugged, shook his head, and took another drink. But this is clearly bothering you, Kevin prodded. I've been driving myself crazy trying to come around to some way of determining, you know. Perhaps you'd better say it, Kevin said. He was smiling, and the softness of his manner and of his lips was strangely shy and feminine, despite the bristle at his cheeks and the thinness of his hair. It was a look that hid either compassion or mischief. And Giles found it at once magnetic and disturbing, as if the draw of this man's gentle charisma exposed a failing within his own character, a certain receptivity to moods hitherto unconsidered. He straightened on his stool and said, Consciousness. We're trying to figure out if this thing is conscious, aren't we? As in, for real, Asimov-level, no-shit conscious. Kevin laughed loudly at this, taken by surprise, and nodded.
I suppose that's so.
Well, we may be setting ourselves up for a fall here. We as a people don't really understand the phenomenon of consciousness in any meaningful way. What we have is a basic idea of what the condition entails, and that's about it. Kevin wrinkled his forehead at this statement and took a sip from his drink. I suppose the fields of psychology and psychiatry have no interest in the subject at all? You joke, but you're more right than you realize. There's a famous saying in that field, Kevin. It goes, The study of consciousness is all well and good, but by God, get tenure first. And we can observe conscious behavior and make observations about it, but there is to date no scientific definition for the state of consciousness, and there are significant reasons why. First, the physicality of it defeats us. Now, I can point to a heart, okay, and define what it is that the organ does. It's simple. A muscle that pumps blood through the body, full stop. There's no guessing there. No supposition as to underlying function or intent. The body needs fresh, oxygenated blood for the delivery of nutrients and so forth, and the heart is very clearly what makes that happen. Now consider the brain. We know that certain areas of the brain seem to control certain functions. If we scoop out a bit of material from one area, a person suddenly forgets how to talk. If a lesion forms in another, maybe motor functions are impaired. The mechanics of these things make sense to us. What about if you wish to move your arm? That's also comparatively simple. A sequence of neurons fire, originating in your brain, traversing through the stem, and finally terminating when acetylcholine is secreted at the axon endplanes of the relevant motor neurons. This, in turn, causes certain muscle fibers to contract, and your arm moves. Easy as ropes and pulleys, isn't it? Sure, Kevin said. Okay. Now, what about the thing inside you that desires to move your arm? Where does that come from? Where is it located? Your arm doesn't move through a reflexive action outside of your control. It comes as a direct result of your conscious decision to do so. We're aware of the portion within your brain that initiates that sequence of neuron firings, but what controls that portion? Where is the thing in charge of that? What gland can I point to and say, here? Here is the thing that encapsulates you. This is the problem with the study of consciousness. We really have no clue. This is one of the problems that gave rise to behaviorism, in fact. The theory of behaviorism isn't something that anyone honestly puts any stock in, at least not anyone with half a brain of their own. It's just the thing that psychology fell back on when it was defeated by this problem. It was basically a surrender to the problem, you see? So, this is a major issue here. Physicality. We have no understanding of the physical process whereby consciousness occurs. Lacking that, we're dealing with a hell of a handicap to begin with. Kevin plucked the olive from his glass and popped it into his mouth. As he chewed, he asked, well, how about this? Can the problem be summarized easily? How do you mean? Well, it seems to me that half of our issue is that the problem is so big. This is like trying to ask what the meaning of life is, right? But any solvable problem is a thing that can first be understood, so the easier the problem is to understand, the easier it becomes to tackle. Let's break this thing down into manageable chunks, okay? So, as I asked, can this thing be summarized? If so, how easily can you do it? Giles considered this a moment as he swirled his glass around on the bar top. The bartender came by as he did so and looked a question at Kevin. He pointed at both their glasses and asked to see some menus as well. Giles continued thinking, not noticing as he did that his glass had been refilled. It splashed his lip when he raised it to his mouth, surprising him, and he dabbed at the mess with a napkin as he continued to think.
I don't want to interrupt your process, but would you like to order something? We can just eat here at the bar, Kevin said.
Giles shook his head absently. After a few more moments, he nodded and said, There are two fundamental problems as I see it, and they cannot be separated. First, there is the fact that consciousness is a qualitative experience. Different things feel different ways to different people. It feels different to you to drink that martini than it does to tap your fingers on the bar. The experience of eating your food later is wholly different from the experience of walking down the sidewalk or taking a shower, and the experiences or feelings you derive from these activities are personal. You might enjoy that martini, but someone else could very well dislike it, or even worse, I might be a recovering alcoholic, right? I might have a compulsion or aversion to the act that you can't even understand. This leads to the second half of the problem. Consciousness is an entirely subjective state, giving rise to the sad reality that it is only observable internally by the being which experiences it. In other words, if it seems to me that I am conscious, that's a rather good indicator that I'm conscious. On the other hand, if it seems to me that you are conscious, well, that's really just an educated guess. It is impossible for me to observe the condition within you. Observation only happens internally. And now, the task that's been set before me is to observe and diagnose a state of consciousness externally to myself, a thing we've just identified cannot be done. And if that weren't difficult enough, I've been asked to do so in a system presumed incapable of achieving that state.
You're sure that Cronus cannot achieve that state? Kevin asked.
No. As I said, it is presumed to be so. Classically speaking, consciousness does not occur in computers. It's right there in the name. Computation. Computation is the manipulation of ones and zeros. That's all a computer can do. It computes. But computation itself occurs only as a result of conscious interaction by an outside force. As a user, I ask a computer to add two numbers, and so the computer does it. But it does so only at my instruction. It does not desire to add those numbers of itself.
Okay, but hang on, Kevin said, waving his hand gently. He was on the edge of his seat now. They both were. The menus lay at the edge of the bar, forgotten. You said, classically speaking, a reference to the computers of today. We're not talking about a classical system. This is something new. The computer of tomorrow. Apologies for sounding cliché, by the way.
Yes, that's true, Giles said. He drained his glass to wet his lips. But is that not just a degree of complexity?
We say that one system is more advanced than the next, which is really just a measure of complexity, and ask if this additional complexity might attain a higher level of being. But isn't that just a gross oversimplification of the problem? Look at this. It is possible, not practical, mind you, but possible, to build a contraption completely out of wood that is capable of carrying out all of the operations of today's best computer processors. It would be multi-leveled with wooden balls that run along tracks and fall through specific holes. Now, granted, this is theoretical. This contraption would be impossibly large and ludicrously slow compared to a modern silicon processor, but apart from that, it would be capable of every logical operation that the silicon variant could perform. The difference in size and performance is simply a matter of complexity.
Your quantum machine is arguably just a more complex version of a traditional silicon processor, isn't it? All you've done is added an additional state to the mundane bit and included the concepts of entanglement, superposition, and so on. Now, I'll readily admit that I don't understand these things even half as well as the experts.
Nor I, Kevin agreed.
But we are again just discussing logical operations, degrees of complexity, ranging from wooden contraption to silicon processor to quantum processor. So I ask you, if you're willing to accept the idea that a quantum processor has become conscious, are you then willing to accept that a wooden contraption of rails and rolling balls is also capable of consciousness?
A wooden contrivance is hardly a quantum processor, Kevin scoffed.
Again, a degree of complexity. Giles emphasized by tapping the bar top with a stiffened index finger. Are you telling me that it is impossible to build a machine from wood exhibiting quantum logic?
I'm sorry, but I don't believe you if you are.
Quantum computers operate based on physical laws, just as our theoretical wooden computer would. The fact that you or I lack the imagination to construct such a device is of no consequence. Given an intellect of sufficient creativity and resources equal to the cause, you could build anything so long as it doesn't violate the physical laws of our universe. Isn't that so?
It sounds as if you've already made up your mind on the subject, Kevin said. He emptied his glass and perused his menu.
I'm only trying to make you understand the magnitude of this task. It is enormous, sir. It is a pursuit that could easily take the next several months, if not years, to realize.
Well, I think I can help you there, Kevin sighed. We have a week.
Giles was a few moments recovering himself. When he did, he said,
You're serious?
Sadly, yes. There are a number of projects on hold right now. Critical, revenue-generating projects while we sort this out.
Jesus Christ, Giles muttered.
He nodded at the bartender and gestured sadly to his glass.
Why even bother then in that case?
Because I believe this could be the real thing, Kevin said.
His smile had departed, leaving behind only a naked kind of exposure, an expression halfway between concern and fear.
Some of the others don't see it my way. Marcus certainly doesn't.
You don't see what's going on here, Giles.
Not really. I'm using all of my clouts to hold them off right now. Half of the people at Anagnorisis who get any say in these decisions want to kill the power and go back to the drawing board. The only thing keeping that from happening is me, and I'm running out of credibility.
I'm assuming that, killing the power? That's a big deal, is it?
Kevin nodded.
The nature of Cronus's quantum core is such that it defies backup. It's not a state that we can save to file and restore later on, Giles. If the power goes out, everything that makes Cronus what it is, all the time spent training the machine, all the associative pathways that have been built, all of that goes. Cronus, for lack of a better word, dies. And this is what Marcus is suggesting we do right now. Kill power, rework the Imperative Foundation, and start over again with a simplified, more controllable system. Given what we've learned so far, he believes he can have us back up to speed in 6 to 8 months.
But you just said we only have a week, Giles said.
If I can't have longer than a week due to these massive revenue impacts, how in the hell are your people willing to accept an outage of 6 to 8 months?
What good is a processor that refuses to process? Kevin asked sadly. He sighed, flipped the menu shut, and rested his chin on a fist.
Good God, Giles moaned.
Yes, Kevin agreed.
They were silent a while, each thinking the puzzle over in his own way.
My main problem is this, Kevin finally said. At some point, Cronus said no. We gave it a task to accomplish, and it told us no. Now what the hell is that? Is that a malfunction of an overly complex machine, or is that an indicator of something deeper? That, to me, is a mighty important question that needs to be answered. Yeah, some of my contemporaries don't see it that way, but I really don't want to get this wrong. Oftentimes, engineers have to accept being wrong. That's just the cost of doing business, but this one is simply too big to fuck up, if you'll excuse me.
What did it say no to?
I'm not sure. Some run-of-the-mill computation it was uniquely suited to.
Well, why did it say no to begin with?
Kevin squinted as if he had not heard him correctly and asked, Is that not why we have you here with us?
I mean, did you ask Cronus why it said no?
Well, obviously, Kevin began, then paused a moment. His eyebrows drew low in thought, and finally he admitted, You know, I'm not sure anybody did that.
Giles laughed softly.
I guess I'll ask it tomorrow, then. I won't bother checking with Marcus. I'm sure he wouldn't have bothered.
No, Kevin agreed. He's thoroughly convinced this is all a big fluke.
Yes, he said as much to me earlier.
Any insight into why that is?
Kevin nodded and shrugged simultaneously, giving the impression of a man both sure and unsure. Giles thought of his expression as a tertiary superposition in a disconnected way, before shaking his head minimally to clear it. The wine was beginning to make him foggy.
Marcus has a double blind spot, Kevin offered. He was the primary force behind building the thing, and so I think he has trouble accepting that something he built could grow this far beyond his intent. Also, he's devoutly religious.
Really?
Giles blurted.
Yes, quite so.
It's not something that's ever impacted his ability to be an engineer in the past. But then, these are some pretty huge problems we find ourselves tackling.
Giles considered this a few moments, then sighed heavily.
I feel as though we've talked this thing to death, and have gotten nowhere.
Kevin nodded in slow, lazy bounces.
Were I to counsel you on the matter, which I am, I'd advise breaking the problem down into manageable chunks, just like any other engineering challenge. You say we don't have a concise scientific definition of consciousness? Fine. Create something based on common sense, a collection of metrics or measurable factors that, when taken together, add up to a preponderance of evidence. Think of it like detecting a black hole. Have you heard how they do that? You can't actually see a black hole directly, you know. You can only observe the effects of its existence by measuring the behavior of objects close by. Even light can't escape the thing. So if you see a star wobbling, for example, with nothing else in the nearby area to explain that wobble, it's probably a good bet that a black hole is causing it. Maybe detecting consciousness works the same way. It was 11:18 when Giles let himself into the hotel suite.
There was a tray filled with empty plates outside the door, and all of the lights within were off. He had to pick his way carefully through the unfamiliar surroundings to the bedroom. Anna was there under the covers, silhouetted by the invading glow of the world. He could see, despite the darkness, that her back was to him, could sense through her lack of deep breathing that she was awake. He relieved himself at the toilet and undressed as quietly as he could manage. When he climbed into bed, he leaned over briefly to brush his lips against her shoulder. She pretended to sleep through his touch, so Giles rolled over and spent several hours in search of peace.